Hi, I'm Jack Black. Welcome to Mind Stories, an occasional series of podcasts. Over the years, I've had amazing experiences with through conversations with extraordinary men and women, either those who are using the Mind Store techniques and methods and tools to achieve awesome things or turn around adversity, and then other people too who have similar attitudes. So the first one here today is a conversation I had earlier on with Anne Hughes, a Glaswegian lady. She had an amazing experience a few months back, and she tells a story. I'm trusting, like me, you're going to be truly inspired by it. So have a listen, enjoy, and I'll speak to you again at the end. Hi, everybody. I've got Anne Hughes on the line here today. Anne's had an momentous experience happen to her a little while back there. It's one of these great mind stories in the sense that her attitudes, her drive, her passion for life, and so on, is going to come through. She's a wonderful person. I've known her for quite a long time. And welcome to the podcast. It's great. I'm really delighted that you're on.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Jack.
And maybe what we could do is, because a lot of people who will be listening to this will be Mindstone members, people have done courses, whether it's in their work or whether it's just coming to public courses and stuff. What's your Mindstone credentials? You know, when did you first get involved with it?
Okay, I think, Jack, it was at the end of the 90s. I did one of the big Royal Concert Hall ones. My sister was really keen to do it, and the two of us decided to come along and give that a try. I know it was definitely before I had got married or had kids, which is why I'm reckoning it was the end of the 90s. And obviously, I had a great time. Like I think you say so often, I used it for car parking spaces all the time. Nothing very momentous in my life. But really loved the principles and believed in the principles of it. Then as the sort of years went on, I did it a few times, and then at the time I was working in a charity fundraiser. I was working for a charity, and I ended up getting in touch with you, and you did an event or a couple of events for the charity where we could raise extra money. Which it was Anthony Rowan Leukemia Charity, and that was a wonderful help at the time, and really great for us to get to know each other. So I've sort of known you since then, and we've spoke a few times over the years. I've always been trying to hatch different plans about what I wanted to do with my life. A few years back, it was trying to start up spiritual events in Glasgow, and you were on hand to help me with that as well. And then most recently, obviously, you've seen on Facebook what I was going through, and you were in touch with me, and then I came along to the Whispers with Giants, which I found really powerful, and have been using and continue to use. And anyone who's done Whispers of Giants, I put Wonder Woman in my room, because I have to go for MRI scans because of what happened for me, and it's quite a scary experience, actually, an MRI, or it was when I wasn't well. And so I'm going again next Monday, and I will be harnessing Wonder Woman in the days leading up to that, and speaking to her in there and getting that sort of I feel I need to be quite fearless and quite strong for going for these tests again. So that's my mind stored credentials.
And what about your life before the momentous event? You know, what were you doing? I know you've got kids and stuff. When we first met, you didn't have, obviously, you were involved in the charity.
So life is good. I always tell people, this is interesting about the words we use, I always tell people I'm the luckiest woman you'll ever meet. And that is, so I'm married, I've got three kids, I'm a fundraiser for a wonderful Glasgow-based charity. But one of my other most used terms, would you believe, is you're bursting my brain, or it is bursting my brain. I used to say it all the time. So life was good. I do now reflect on it and think I had maybe fallen off my purpose. I had got very comfortable with life being what it was, and I wasn't meditating as much. I wasn't thinking about my bigger goals and my bigger ambitions. They had all just started to fade into the background. So I feel as if you know, what happened earlier this year was maybe a bit of a wake-up call for me. I have to see the positive in it, and I also feel I have to see that I must have done something to bring it into my life, because it happened in my body. So, it sort of put me back on track, I think.
Wonderful.
And that's what's happened.
So the listeners are going to be wondering what happened. Do you want to tell us a wee bit about that day and what unfolded and stuff?
Yeah, so it was just a normal. So I'm 42 year old. I was 41 at the time, mother of three, living in Glasgow. And it was just a normal Sunday. I had been out for my shopping. I was sitting on the sofa with my kids. My husband, he's wonderful, he was making dinner, and he shouted dinner was ready. So I got up and went into the kitchen and got the most almighty pain behind my eye. At first, sort of, we were thinking it was a migraine. I went back into the living room, sat on the couch, and it all starts to get a bit hazy then, but I knew it was more. he put tablets in my hand for me to take migraine leave, and I couldn't work out how to put my hand to my mouth to put the tablets into my mouth.
Right.
So at that point, he phoned NHS 24 and they said, you need to phone an ambulance. And the ambulance service were great and stayed on the line to him.
Yeah.
I always see the positive. So it was the perfect time. It was a Sunday evening, about 6 o'clock, 6:30. And so the roads were empty. An ambulance got here very quickly and I was rushed to the Southern General. And I had had a brain aneurysm, which, wow, I think we had no clue. I would imagine the ambulance crew probably knew, or anybody that knew what an aneurysm was. So I had had a massive bleed on my brain. They had to cut open my skull that night to let the blood out because there was so much blood build up that it was obviously compressing my brain.
Yes.
My husband was told I was going to die that night. Oh. And for 10 days they couldn't actually operate on my brain to close the aneurysm because there was just too much blood, so they couldn't see. So they said it was miraculous that I was still alive.
Wow.
And that I actually, for those 10 days, which I'd have no even though I was awake for some of it, I have no recollection of, I was put into a coma. And for those 10 days, everything hung in the balance, really, because if the aneurysm had started to bleed again, the chances of me surviving that were very slim. Mm. But luckily, I've always had low blood pressure, and I think that was a real help. It caused me to faint when I was having my kids, but that was a real help. And so, I was just there for 10 days, and then, and my husband doesn't, you know, he calls me a hippie, obviously, I love calling myself a hippie, but it ended up being an interventionalist that operated, and she was lovely, and Gary, when he met her, my husband said, like, she was a bit of a hippie too, which isn't really what a brain surgeon ever is, because, you know, they're,
yes,
very, very big arrogant,
yeah,
men, and I love,
yes,
that, because they think they can fix brains, and they do fix brains, so you want,
yeah,
a big arrogant man go and operate on brains, don't you? But she would come and put her hands on my face and cuddle my kids and explain to, like, my daughter, who was 13, explain to her what was happening. And she actually fixed my brain, beginning up through my groin and taking everything she needed up through my arteries and into my brain and fixing it, which blows my mind, actually.
Yeah, amazing. That's when doctors,
mm-hmm,
are just wonderful, aren't they?
So, and she was from Madrid, and I'm hoping that I do get the opportunity to see her again, because she's not my consultant, because it's a brain surgeon that's my consultant, but I do hope that I get the chance to see her again. So, and very interestingly, my personality was the first thing to come back, so I'm always big on being nice to people and people by people and all this.
Yeah.
And my husband said I was just totally on form as soon as I woke up, chatting up all the doctors and everything, so I think it was quite entertaining, although worrying for everybody else.
Yes.
But I'm here, and it's now 27, 28 weeks past, and I'm feeling great, and I think I'm probably the healthiest I've ever been. So,
fantastic. Let's go back a wee minute, if you don't mind, because I know people will want to know, what did you mean by interventionist? Some people might not know what that means.
So that's, I think, a kind of doctor. They're called an interventionalist. I didn't know what they were before, but I don't know. We would probably need to Google it, because I don't actually know. But she went in to operate on me, going through my groin. If it hadn't worked, then she wouldn't have been able to open my brain. It would have had to have been a brain surgeon that came and opened my brain. So they sort of operate by taking a camera inside your body and doing the operation with everything that they take in on that wee camera.
Right, got you.
And so it's very specialised. I've heard it's very, very specialised,
wow,
to have an interventionist.
Wow.
And how lucky am I that I live in Glasgow,
yeah,
with this amazing neurology team up the road.
My goodness. Okay, so I know from previous conversations we've had, you know, when you regained your awareness, you know, the 12 days on or 13 days on, whatever it was, tell us a wee bit about that and where you were and the people around you and what you were observing.
Yeah, so I was really lucky that I've got lots of wonderful people in my life. So my husband, my sisters, my brother, my friends were there a lot of the time. I think I was very unsure and asked them a lot of times. They had to explain to me about 2 every 5 minutes why I was in hospital, because my memory was really, really bad,
yes,
at the time.
Yes.
But my first conscious thought was, thank goodness that I know better than this. Thank goodness that I can fix this in my mind before I can fix it anybody else. Because,
wow,
at this stage now, it was all looking good. I had had the brain surgery. My legs and everything were moving, because that was a risk, because I wear the part of my brain that was a risk that I would have been left with a disability.
Yes.
So everything was moving, everything was working. So I knew I was now okay, and I was just to get better. And I thought, I know how to fix this. I'll fix it in my mind first. And,
wow,
to the extent that, as I say, I'm somebody that talks to everybody and literally can make a pal in a queue in Asda, I never spoke to the people I was in a ward with, which is not like me at all. I couldn't listen to music because it was just too much. for my head. Yes. But I would put in, if I didn't have a visitor, I would put in my headphones, I would put on an eye mask, and I would not engage with conversation with the other patients, because I very much felt I need to protect my energy here. And they were whingers, because I could hear them. So they were people that were, and God bless them, they were all there for horrible things, you know. But I just thought, I know better than this. I can't get involved in conversations that have me feeling sorry for myself.
Wow.
So I have to be in conversations about how I'm getting better. And so I would go totally into myself. I would go into a meditation, and I would be totally visualising myself 6 months on, being well, being at home, taking my kids out. And, you know, one day my body was really sore, and I said to the consultant, and he said, it's because there's been such a build-up of blood, Anne, and that blood's all sort of a bit off now and has to move through your body. And so for like a whole day, I just visualised blood rushing through my body as fast as it possibly could and renewing itself. And I believe that that worked. I really firmly believe that that worked, because yes. By that night, after he told me that, I visualised that all day long, and by that night, my body felt fine. And so I was really glad that I had started with Mindstore and all the other stuff that I've done in the last sort of, you know, 20 years, because in all the reading I've done, this has to start in my mind, because I could have became a victim at that point.
Tell us a bit more about that, because you did tell me before that there were people of that mind around you, wasn't there?
Yeah, so the people around me, there was somebody opposite me who was a real poor soul and was in a terrible way, and she didn't really communicate. And there was another woman beside me who had lost her voice, which was something that happened to me, I can tell you in a minute, but she had completely lost the ability to speak, and hers was on a neurological level. I had also lost the ability to speak, but mine was because they had damaged my throat during intubation, so I knew I was going to be able to speak again. They knew I could speak again. It was just damaged. My throat was all bruised because they looked at it. They put cameras down. Yes. So they knew that it was that. Yeah. But other people weren't in a great way. And when they then moved me into another ward, that was people that knew they had aneurysms that they had found. So theirs hadn't just popped like mine unexpectedly and I never knew. They knew they had aneurysms and they were coming in to get operations done. So they were understandably terrified, because we wouldn't be. Some older people who were just maybe not had the best energy maybe in the first place, I don't know. And so they were very much about, this doctor said that and I don't like that nurse and he said this. And they would sit at night with their mugs of tea, like at bedtime, it was in a room of four, and the other three people, so a lady maybe in her 50s, a girl in her 40s, and an older woman in her 60s, and they would all sit around one of their beds with their mugs of tea, and they would just moan about the position they were in. Now, the utmost sympathy and compassion for them, because it is scary. I would rather it popped the way it did than I knew it and I had to go into hospital and wait for operations, you know. That would have been awful. But I knew I wasn't going to go and sit with them, which anybody who would know me would know that's not Anne. I go and sit with anybody that's having a chat. But I knew that I'm not listening to you, and I would put earplugs in and I would put an eye mask on and I wouldn't even listen to them. So I can't even tell you too much about what they were saying. But it wasn't good.
You just knew it was negative and stuff.
And even the energy in the room wasn't good.
Yes.
So getting home from hospital after, I was doing better and they were feeding me with tubes and everything. I was all tubes everywhere. And when they all came out, I knew then that I needed to get home. I needed to be back in my own energy. I needed to be in the energy of people that cared about me and that were going to keep being positive and be in my own energy alone, actually, as well, instead of being in all these other people's energy. Because the hospital is a busy, scary big place, isn't it? So
Of course. And did any of the hospital staff, you know, even from the auxiliary staff through to nurses and obviously the doctors and so on, did they say anything, pass comment about your attitude or your mind approach? Well, were they aware of it, or did you think they went past them? Or?
No, I think it was my consultant, Mr. Grievous, who was from Greece. The doctor at that point said to me, this is miraculous recovery that you've made, Anne, and you had to play a role in that because you were so poorly that to see you walk in here, you know, sort of 6 weeks after this has happened to you and be able to stand up. And, you know, obviously I had got myself dressed and I'd done my hair and I'd put on a wee bit of flap, so I was looking all right. And he was like, this is miraculous. So, and that was obviously, you know, coming from somebody where there's a wee bit of a language barrier and stuff like that. And I still was just starting to speak again. And so I feel very much that the staff The staff were lovely on the whole. There was one that wasn't very nice, but I was sort of putting compassion out there. Who would be you? But the staff were great, and I'll tell you, a fantastic a girl that I went to nursery, primary and secondary, but haven't seen in about 20 years, was one of the sisters.
Wow.
Wasn't that lovely that there was somebody there who I felt knew me as me and not me as this woman lying in a bed?
Yeah.
And I think that really helped my energy as well, because I thought, there's somebody in here that knows I'm not this person. So,
Wow. So that awareness you had throughout this initial recovery period was so important.
Yep, definitely. And I knew that, and I've got, you know, some really positive pals. And I think I probably spoke to you quite early on as well, Jack.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
We had those conversations as well about, you need to stay in that energy, and I've very much kept that. And while I've got loads of wonderful people in my life, maybe some people haven't turned up quite as much as I would have expected them to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not taking that personally. I'm thinking maybe your energy wasn't the energy I needed around me at this point.
Yeah.
I needed people that could come through my door and know who I am and how positive I am, because not all my friends share my beliefs.
Of course.
But they knew that it was important to me, so they all got totally on board with it.
That's wonderful.
And so I was glad to see the people that turned up for me and the way they turned up, because there could have been some people that turned up for you and their energy, and that wouldn't have been good for me.
No.
You know, so I was very conscious, and I've become very conscious of who I surround myself with and sort of what that can do to your energy and your ambition and everything that you've got going on in your life.
Wow, yeah. Going back to if you like, the heat of it, you know, when you were recovering and you were out, have the awareness and you were managing the people around you, managing your own thoughts, you know, meditating and so on, and doing your visualizations. I mean, people possibly would be, you used the word a few, some of it would be terrifying for people, you know. How did you deal with, how do you think you dealt with the fear, or did you just not have it, or did it come at you in waves?
I didn't have it. It's
wonderful.
Bizarre, because I'm not saying I'm the most brave person in the world, but I didn't have it. Even when I was, when it was all happening downstairs, I can't remember the pain. According to my husband and my daughters, who were only 9 and 13, you know, so I was clearly in a lot of pain, because I was grabbing my head, I was going back and forward. I can't remember any of that.
No.
I do remember is at one point saying to my husband, "What do you think's happening to me?"
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "I don't know," when we're waiting in the ambulance. And I said, "Do you think I'm dying?" And I said that, and I felt bad afterwards that I'd said that to him, because that could have potentially been the last thing I said to him.
Yes.
But I remember saying it, and I remember having the thought and the feeling, but I didn't feel scared.
No.
And I never even felt scared in the hospital. I always knew I was going to be okay. I always had that knowing that, no, I'm going to be fine. You know, that's a given. That was a given for me. So I didn't feel scared. I didn't feel fear. I have to be honest. I'm really pleased that I didn't.
That's wonderful. I was talking to someone yesterday about, who's recently lost someone with cancer. And she mentioned this thing about the fear of dying.
Uh-huh.
It's probably bigger than the actual, you know, being in a situation like yourself. And I just wonder, just for the sake of maybe listeners who are interested in that, I mean, are you comfortable with the notion of death? It's not something that frightens you, or you come to terms with that? Or
I do feel as if, I don't know if we'd go off topic a wee bit, but
okay.
I do feel as if I had a near-death experience.
Yes.
I do feel as if I had a choice to make. By the time I had the awareness that I had a choice to make, I knew I had already made the choice, though, if you understand what I mean.
Yes.
So I knew that I had chosen to stay. So I know that sort of idea that doesn't resonate with everybody.
No.
But that is how I felt in that moment. What's very bizarre is my mum died when I was 13 and my dad died 3 years ago, and I was convinced they were there.
Yes,
completely convinced they were there.
Yeah.
To the extent my daughter, who has never met my mum even, because she died when I was a wee girl, said I was waking up in the hospital and saying, where did Granny Mary go? Because she was here a minute ago, knitting. So I was completely convinced they were there, and I believe that they probably were. So my notion of death is now, and I actually had the thought one day when I thought, if I had died, life has been good, it wouldn't have been that bad.
Yeah.
And very much I had the feeling that there was something else to go to. I mean, I very much had that feeling.
Okay.
So no, I don't have a fear. Have a fear of death at all, actually.
Just interesting. And now you don't have, did you have, before this all happened, were you comfortable with the notion of dying or death? It wasn't something that freaked you? Or...
it probably wasn't something I thought about, to be honest. So no, it's not something that overly something I overly thought about or anything.
I suppose what I'm getting at is, we had this conversation with someone yesterday who was in the healing area, and you know what you're talking about here in terms of your attitude and you're digging deep and you're just, your knowing is so powerful. It's a big, it plays a major part in it, even though if we can't measure it, you know. But nevertheless, we know it's important. You know it's important because you've lived through this. We were just wondering, if do people who are comfortable with the notion of death and dying, do they tend to do better than people who are terrified, even before something happens to them? It was just a kind of idea.
Isn't that an interesting thought? I don't know.
That's okay.
My biggest thing was, my wee boy was only two, and so my biggest thing sort of was, if I had died, I would have just been I'd have been a woman in a photo to him his whole life, because he wouldn't have had any recollection of me. So that was my biggest fear. My biggest fear was that, whereas, you know, I mean, my wee girls are still wee as well, but at least they knew me. So my biggest fear was about leaving my children behind, as opposed to my fear about what I was going to. I had every confidence that whatever I was going to go to, if I had died, would have been good.
Okay, wonderful. So then you get home and families around, the people who are turning up, your friends and others who are coming to visit you, and people like myself phoning you and stuff. You've more or less got them understanding, or there's an awareness from them that this can only be positive conversation. This can only be, you know. So tell us a bit more about what you learned in that phase, you know, that phase from getting out to where you are now.
Yeah, it was difficult, if I'm really honest. Yeah. I had, as I said earlier, I had lost my voice during intubation, so the only meaningful conversation that I was having was the one I was having with myself. And I did go through, my husband reflects on the early couple of sort of a weeks when I was first home, that I just cried a lot. And I think it was just, I never once said, why did this happen to me? Because I always felt like I was strong enough to survive it. Yes. But there was just that fear and uncertainty and vulnerability. Yeah. And I think it's something that we probably need to have a wee think about how we deal with vulnerability. Yes. Because to feel vulnerable, I mean, literally, I was never left alone other than being in my bedroom sleeping. Yes. There was always somebody in the house with me. If my husband had to go out, one of my friends and my sister would come and sit with me. Yeah. Somebody had to literally do everything for me. I mean, my husband was even shaving my legs for me. Yes. So literally washing my hair in the shower. So somebody had to do absolutely everything for me. And that comes with a vulnerability and a helplessness. Yes. That's somebody who's quite empowered and does all the running about and is living their life very fully, as I was before. That was very difficult. But what a learning curve. I feel as if those early months, I learned so much about myself and about my ability to let people help me, and my ability to keep on that positive and think, well, you know, it's rubbish, I can't wash my own hair, but at least there's somebody here to wash my hair for me.
That's very interesting, because a lot of times I was working with some drug addicts last week in Glasgow, funnily enough, and one or two of them talking about the inability to receive compliments, love, help. And then you are, you know, you're using the word to let them help me, let them assist me. So it was a letting, you know, being able to engage in that, in a positive sort of transaction, yeah?
Yeah. And I mean, I was really, how lucky was I that so many people were there to help me, you know, and to do stuff for me? I do think it's interesting, and something I would consider is how you help people. And I think for all of us, when you're helping people that are in a difficult situation, do you help them in a way that empowers them or a way that disempowers them?
Exactly, very interesting.
Because for all the help, and I love it, and a lot of the help was disempowering, and I don't know how it could have been empowering, so I'm not saying I have the answer.
No.
But I would certainly think, before I assumed, if I had someone else in my life just now who was unwell and needed help, I would actually make really conscious decisions about not just doing everything for them, but trying to empower them to do some stuff for themselves.
Wow.
And enabling that, because it was very interesting, and the disempowerment actually started to get me down a wee bit, because I felt as if I wasn't doing anything. I had three kids, I wasn't doing anything for my kids. I felt as if I wasn't here, nobody would notice, because I'm not adding anything. I wasn't even adding my voice at that point.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought, that's how I started to feel. If I wasn't here, what would I add? Yes. You know, nobody would miss me, because they're all just doing everything without me anyway. And even when you would have four or five visitors, and my voice started to come back as a tiny croak, once you've got four or five people in your house, nobody can hear you even if you try to speak. Do you know what I mean? So that was really, it was really interesting. It was, again, interesting to then be able to go back into your own mind with that and think, like, come on, how are you going to think about this? How are you going to frame this, Anne? Because you could frame it as poor me, or you could frame it as I'm lucky to be surrounded by what I am and I'm on my way back. I'm just re-emerging. It's just taking time.
Yeah. It's fantastic that you're sharing this awareness that you had in the moments. When I was out at the cancer clinic in Stuttgart back in October, one of the great things there was a mindfulness teacher they bring in and to do some sessions. And it was great to be in the receiving end rather than being up in front of the audience. And she was doing mindstore type stuff as well, which is wonderful. But what she was saying was that she had been diagnosed three times in her life with life-threatening cancer. And then she said that every time it came, it was a gift. Which in a sense is what I think you're saying too, is that because these things come and you can either frame it as, oh, woe is me, and go into the type of conversations those three women were having in the room with you in the early stages, or weren't having with you but were having, and you refuse to engage in that, and you start building a positive viewpoint, and you start thinking your way through the consequences of all your thoughts and all your actions, and what other people are doing, they're empowering or disempowering it. As you say, you've got the choice. It's a fascinating area, you know. It's quite amazing that people can see this stuff as a gift and search for the gift, and then not only find the gift but use the gift in the rest of their life.
Yeah, and I very much feel, and even, I mean, obviously we're friends on Facebook and you read what I very much see it as a blessing.
Yeah.
Because why would I see it as anything else?
Yes.
It was a blessing and my life stopped. It's like somebody likened it to a computer rebooting. I had to turn off for a while.
Yeah.
And now I feel as if I'm choosing which programs I'm going to re-upload.
Wow.
And so there's lots of beliefs that I'm letting go, quite honestly, and I'm just not letting them back in. And one of the funniest ones is a typical Glaswegian who's completely addicted to diet Iron Brew. I probably drank about 2 litres a day. Shameful. Yes. And now I don't like it. So now I drink water all the time, and wow. I couldn't drive. The DVLA took my licence off me, obviously, for 6 months, so I couldn't drive. So I walk everywhere. I'm now so proud of the fact that I was just actually looking. I've done over 110,000 steps in the last week. It's like my life is completely transformed.
Wow.
My body is transformed. I feel I'm probably healthier than I've ever been because I'm more conscious of what I'm eating. I'm eating in a much more conscious way. I'm conscious of what I'm thinking. I'm conscious of everything I'm putting into my body. I'm conscious of where I'm going and how I'm getting there. And I mean, honestly, who knew when you didn't have a car you could walk places? I don't think I knew that, Jack. So I feel as if it was a blessing. And I'm now thinking, so what is my message in the world going to be? Because I do feel as if I was given a jolt because I had fallen off my path.
Yeah.
So I'm needing to recalibrate what I want to do. And I'm now working on the plans for what I want to try and put out into the world, but I'm very much in a place of allowing. I'm going to try. If it works, fantastic. If it doesn't, that's okay, because my life is quite good.
Yeah.
I'm not pinning all it, and I'm also believing I've got a bigger purpose. So I'm not thinking about doing things, it would be lovely to be able to write a book and be published and have more money and all the rest of it, but my bigger purpose is about changing other, helping people change the way they think.
Yeah.
It is not about something that's internal, it's external. And so, good or bad, it all feels much better to me.
Yeah.
If I thought I was just going out and making lots of money or doing something that was just about improving my life, it wouldn't sit so well with me, and I would fail at it. I know.
Yeah.
I would.
Yeah, wonderful.
Whereas when I have a bigger purpose, so I feel much more on purpose now, and I'm a wee bit scared not to try, Jack, if I'm honest, because I think, what if I don't try? Will something else happen?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Will something else make me get back on the path again?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. My own experience is my mum had a stroke when I was 16, and I went through a whole thing about feeling personally guilty about that. It was somehow my fault. It's, you know, a bizarre thing. You know, it was the first day, the night that she had a stroke was the first day that I ever dogged school. And this bizarre thing that I'd done something so evil by not going to school, just, you know, nicking off and stuff. That somehow or other, God, if there is such a thing, or whatever the universal energy was punishing me through giving my mother a stroke, which is ridiculous, of course, but
yeah.
but you process it and whatever. But the thing is that the independence that thing, because someone had two brothers and a sister, all younger than me, so my dad had to continue. It took him a long time to get back to work. He was doing a lot of, you know, running back to hospital, nursing my mum and stuff. And what was going on was that somebody had to step up to be a kind of a real big brother, and organise food, cook food, learn to cook food, and organise a house sort of thing. So I gained tremendously, and I'm, you know, in all sorts of ways from that independence of suddenly having to step up, you know. Okay. And I wondered, you know, do you see things, gifts that have come to your kids as a result of this in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've always prided myself on being very resilient, and very poignantly had the thought last week that if I hadn't built my resilience, would I have got through this as well as I had? And so building my kids' resilience is has been really important to me.
Yes.
Obviously, I've been on this journey really their whole life, so they already get all the positive messages all the time. So I think that they're good. I mean, certainly when I went back to work, for example, I only went back a few hours a week at first, and my reason for that was I can't tell my kids I'm better, I need to show my kids I'm better.
Right or wrong, I don't know,
because I did go back too early and I wasn't very good. But I felt as if I had to show them I'm better. And so it's all part of that journey, and they know that I'm very much about, we just have to keep moving forward. We need to be resilient with things that happen on a daily basis. You know, as much as yesterday, my 10-year-old in primary six standing for a class rep thing, and you're having the same conversations, like, this only has the importance that you're going to give it, you know, in the grand scheme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could try not to worry about this, and so I think, yeah, that they are, but I think I've been building them for that for years. And you know, I feel as a parent, it's so important to me that I bring up kids that are able to stand on their own and make their own decisions, as opposed to only be able to stand when they're leaning against me.
Wow.
I really want to empower them to be able to do things, and so I let them actually do. My 14-year-old now, I do sometimes let her make some bad decisions, because I think the only way you learn is if you make the decision yourself.
Yeah.
You don't learn if I tell you the decision.
Yeah.
You know, nothing major, obviously.
No,
but that's something that's become really important to me, that I have to build resilient children that are empowered to make their own decisions and be not need everybody else's approval before they make a decision on something.
Wonderful.
That they need their own approval.
Yeah.
You know.
So a couple of other things. You mentioned towards the beginning of our conversation, so at some level you rationalise that you brought this, not saying you brought it on yourself, but you were engaged in it coming into your life, and therefore you're going to learn from it and move from it. Any ideas about that type of stuff? I mean, one of the things, you know, I'm big on the Joanna Budvig thing in Stuttgart with cancer patients,
yeah.
And I know talking to cancer patients regularly about this thing, about why have you got it, resonates with them.
Uh-huh.
It might not resonate with some of the people treating them, but it resonates with them that there's a reason for this. Any thoughts on that? Anything happening there?
I find it, if I'm really honest, I find it difficult. So I worked for cancer charities for, you know, sort of for 17 years or something. So I find it very difficult with cancer, if I'm honest, on a personal level. I do,
losing
my mum to leukaemia when I was 13, you know, I dread to think of that. But when it comes to what happened with me, I feel very much that, of course, we invite everything into our lives, don't we,
yes.
In some level,
yeah.
And that's again about taking responsibility for yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I do think that, I don't know, the doctors don't know what caused it. I didn't have a bump on the head, as I say, I had low blood pressure, so there is no reason why it happened, and they don't know, and they'll never know why it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I do reflect on the fact that I obviously brought it in, and me and my husband have chats about how stressed I would let myself get about things. And it's very interesting, because I just literally let everything go now. I don't hold on to anything.
Good.
Very interestingly, I just say what I think. And it's actually serving me quite well. Because I think I don't want to be in positions where I'm lying, trying to go to sleep at night thinking, I should have just said this, I should have just said that. And I'm always been a plain speaker anyway. Most people would think I've always said what I thought
but
people love honesty. You know, I was trying to get a better deal out of a hotel that one of our supporters has booked for an event and what have you the other day, and I just went to them and I said, quite honestly, this money means more to the organisation I work for than it does to you, because you're a big multinational, you don't. And they just come back and said, no, you're quite right, and it's okay, we'll just do what you want. Now, that could have went one or two ways. He could have actually been really annoyed with me, because it was quite a cheeky email, I'll be honest.
Yes.
But he didn't. He appreciated my honesty. Yes. And so I've decided that's how I'm going to show up in the world now, as a very honest, which probably won't win me everybody. But equally, if it means that I'm not holding on to stuff and I need to just let go of stuff a wee bit more, because that's what I worry, that I just hold too much in my head.
Yeah.
And that's why maybe it happened.
Wow. And that phrase you said right at the beginning, that this is busting my brain, very fascinating. From my point of view, people are using phrases all the time, you know, like I'm sick to my stomach, or, you know, I'm sick to the back teeth or something like this, you know, and you saying this is busting my brain, then God, look what happens. Very interesting that as well, isn't it?
Uh-huh, because I'm very big, I actually am big on affirmations, and I feel as if that was my most used one. I'm the luckiest woman you ever meet, so that's why I was okay.
Yes,
I used to say it all the time. I would tell my kids, you're busting my brain, and my work, if something wasn't working, this computer's busting my brain, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just used to say it all the time. Wow. And fascinating that then my brain literally burst.
Amazing,
so I think
it?
We have to be really careful what we're saying to ourselves.
Yeah, indeed. It's amazing, isn't it? So the other thing you mentioned about taking out the Iron Brew, Scotland's national drink, which is a big issue, of course, because of the sugar and stuff. I mean, is there anything else that you're doing in terms of, have you looked into, you know, some of the thoughts around about how you prevent brain disease and stuff? Are you any look at any of that?
I haven't, if I'm honest, Jack. I haven't engaged with all that too much. I'm making much more conscious choices. I'm still not got the best health and the best diet in the world and everything, but it is far, far improved to what it was. And I'm actually at a stage where I've decided I'm going to try being a vegetarian, you know, sort of a 4 or 5 days a week, just to see how that balances out with my body and be much more conscious of everything I'm putting in. But I haven't done that. But at the start, my sister was doing that, looking up brain health books and what was the best food for it, and making me all these elaborate things that was going to be good and boost brain power. But I haven't engaged with that probably as much as I could have.
Oh, that's fine. It's interesting. The next little podcast I've got lined up is someone who's taken to this keto type or low carb, high fat, moderate protein type diet because she read Grain Brain and Wheat Belly and stuff. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what she's got to say, because it's kind of turned her around to another Glasgow lady, someone you may know, but you'll certainly hear her when we do it. So, you know, it's fascinating. Any other big lessons, Anne, for people listening?
I think the biggest one, funnily enough, being a Mindstone member in Glasgow, there's a Mindstone meetup group, which I've always been in the group but never gone along to.
Yes,
and I went along to that at the beginning of August. I think it's the first Wednesday of the month, and I wrote a list of 30 objectives we were doing that, and this was fascinating. I have decided that everything that I want comes into my life, so I need to be careful. I literally put on that list, I want to wear beautiful clothes. I got home, I made a mug of tea, I sat down, I opened my phone, and I had just won £100 of Fraser's vouchers. and wee things like that, I've never bought anything in Fraser's in my life until that point, and wee things like that keep happening in my life. You know, I keep getting like I'm not going to remember them all because, as I said, my short-term memory isn't great, but wee things like that just keep happening. I almost can manifest something very, very quickly. I wanted a night away from me and my husband, and I won an overnight dinner, bed and breakfast in the Grand Central Hotel, and we're going tomorrow, you know? So it's like things like that are just manifesting very quickly. So again, I'm sitting sort of holding myself in and saying, just be careful what you're wanting to manifest in your life, Anne.
Aye, interesting, isn't it?
I think that's been a big lesson for me, that we do have the power to just actually manifest stuff
into
our lives.
I actually say to people, look, once you've done this stuff and you start using it, you won't remember what your life was like before, because what you just said there, you've got all these small coincidences or manifestations of things. You get so many of them, you become blasé and you don't even notice them.
Yeah,
but there's, totally. But there's so many of them that's happening to you. Just with the way that you're thinking and attracting, from times you get little reminders to be aware of it and see how wonderful they are, and sometimes how big they can be. But they're so compelling, and at the same time affirming everything we're talking about here. I mean, it's wonderful.
And I'm enjoying going to that group. And the reason I decided to start going to the meetup is, again, because I come back to who am I surrounding myself with? Do I want to surround myself with people that are maybe not in the best wavelength?
Yes.
Even though I might love them and they're my friends and my work colleagues and I like them and my family, you know. But if I could go and spend 3 hours a month with people that are all about setting goals, that are all about ambition, then is that not a great spend of my time?
Yeah. And that group's
amazing. And it was actually, it's in Steps, and it's the first Wednesday of the month. And my friend that I went with last month, she drove. I got my driving licence back this week, so fantastic. But I don't have a car because I've just ordered a new car. I'm leasing a car. Right. And I was thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get to Steps. I'm going to miss it on the 6th of September. I don't know how I'm going to get. And then I thought, it's fine. We'll just manifest that. And I got notification that my car's getting delivered on the morning of the 6th of September. So I'm actually going to have my own car and be able to drive myself to Steps for the next meetup. So then again, you know, and a funny one, I know we're going on with time, is a paramedic was beautiful to me. I can't remember his face or anything. And he said to me, when I said, can I please shut my eyes? He said, and you're fine, I've got you. You've got powerful words to say to somebody. Wow. And I set the intention, I need to find that guy and meet him. Well, yeah. Next Saturday, there's an event called the Casualty Cup. And they've chosen the charity I work for as their beneficiary. Wow. And I didn't know that much about it. I met with them last week. And I realised it's nurses and doctors and paramedics. Nurses and doctors from accident emergency and paramedics. They do a football league and then they do a big ball at night. Yeah. I'm going to meet the paramedic next Saturday night.
Lovely, lovely.
And it's just like there, that's these things that you just manifest. You just set the intention and it just happens for you.
Yeah. And you've been an absolute pleasure to share this. And I'm sure everybody listening is going to be really grateful too.
Thank you. No, thanks, wonderful. Jack. Thank you for inviting me on.
And thanks for mentioning the Glasgow group, they're awesome, and you know, likewise in Dublin and London for the people listening, you know, get in touch with them. There's not a lot of like-minded people to the degree of the awareness that you've talked about throughout this call. Those guys who go to those groups tend to have that awareness, and mm-hmm. and by sharing and being one of those company, it boosts everybody's morale, you know.
Yeah, and the Glasgow one's the first Wednesday of the month, as I say, so that's just like less than a fortnight away now, and very welcoming. I was a wee bit nervous, thinking, just pitching up, nobody knows me, but, you know, they were delighted. There was a few new people there that night, and they were very delighted, and I'm looking forward to going again and just having that regular plug right into other people saying, right, what goals are we setting this month, what are we going to do, and it's just a really good way, and, you know, it doesn't cost anything, it's just your time to get there, you know, Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to engaging more with that as well. Yeah, so it's great that people are running these.
I think it's wonderful that they're also practical sessions. They're not just, you know, sitting around having a chat about positive stuff. They actually do things, which is fantastic.
We set 30 goals. We whittled them down to 7 goals. We listened to some of your podcasts, some of your wee videos and things like that. Yep. And we did some meditations and went over the water to the House of the Red Roof and everything. So it was really, really valuable.
Great stuff. Well, listen, Anne, thanks again. For coming on and being willing to share so much. It's been awesome. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Jack.
Cheers, Anne. Bye now.
Speak soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What a wonderful first podcast. What a lady Anne is. She's amazing. I'm so delighted that she agreed to do this for us and inspire us all. The next podcast will be along soon enough. Hope you get the opportunity to listen to that one too. You hear Anne talking enthusiastically there about the Glasgow Group. She mentioned the date, the 6th of September, for the meeting in Steps. And the Dublin group is meeting on the 7th of September. Looks like it might be the Hoth Sailing School or the sailing club up there at Hoth. So if you're interested in getting involved with those groups, the London, I got in touch with them, but haven't come back yet. Presumably August being August in England, then they're probably on holiday. They might start again, I would imagine, the end of September. So if you get in touch with us at info@meinstor.com, we can certainly let you know when any of the groups are on. And as these podcasts continue, I can let you know. And more importantly, if you do follow me on Facebook, Twitter and so on, social media, then we'll let you know too. Probably find there might be the odd newsletter coming along, because there's a big course coming up in Glasgow. It's a one-off. It's the Island. Came about by a series of coincidences. Had to listen to them. I'm really looking forward to teaching that. And then, of course, next season again with Whisper of the Giants, it was encouraging again for Anne to say how important that course has been for her. So we can all look forward to that. Anyway, hope you're still enjoying your summer. I certainly am, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye now.